Chapter 19. The Presence in the Corner. The suburb to which I had moved was on the local railway line. From the station, a road ran north, and from this road, at regular intervals, the still unmade-up roads extended east towards the middle of the peninsula and west towards the coast. Rask's flat was located in a square white building, very similar to all its square white neighbours, which was situated near the end of 18th Road, one of the last side roads to the west. It was a small flat, consisting, besides the usual offices, of a lounge, a bedroom and a kitchen. The lounge was furnished Western style with a sofa, two armchairs, a coffee table and a bookcase containing, as I soon discovered, a stack of Time magazines. Numerous American and Russian novels, not the classics, and the 10-volume official biography of Mahatma Gandhi. Here I was installed, Rask having come and fetched me and my small luggage from the Ananda Vihara, and here, for the next 2 months and more, I stayed. The lounge was very quiet, as was the rest of the flat, and indeed the whole building. This was due principally to the road not being a through road, but coming to an abrupt end at the edge of a piece of waste ground, beyond which were only the huts of the dark-skinned fisher folk, who, until a few centuries ago, had been the sole occupants of the seven islands that were now the city of Bombay. In circumstances thus propitious, it did not take me long to settle down, and 2 or 3 days after moving to Kar, I resumed work on the survey. As my custom was, I worked on it in the morning, usually managing to complete 3 or 4 foolscap pages before lunch. After lunch, I rested and read, dipping into Rask's bookcase, and in the afternoon or evening, sometimes until late at night, my script writer friend and I would discuss the storyline or the dialogue of Ajanta, as well as the Hindi novelette he was writing. At least such was our routine initially. Before a week had passed, Rask was having to spend much of the day out on business of his own, sometimes leaving the flat early in the morning and not returning until 11 or 12 at night, to the ill-concealed annoyance of his young wife, who disliked spending the whole day with only the 2 teenage maidservants for company. For my part, I did not mind having extra time in which to work on the survey, especially as B.P. Wadia was getting the manuscript typed and had started sending me bulky instalments of typescript for correction. Nor did I mind having extra time for the exploration of Rask's bookcase, and besides reading several of the modern American and Russian novels, of which only Hemingway's The Old Man and the Sea really impressed me, I had not read any Hemingway before, managed to get through Kenneth Walker's Venture with Ideas, and Axel Mintz's The Story of San Michel, and to make a start on the multi-volume Mahatma. My exploration of his bookcase led to some lively discussions with Rask when he was at home, and I formed the impression that he was happier to talk about literature than to finish revising the script of Ajanta, to serious work on which we got down only several weeks later. His tastes were very different from my own, modern American authors being the principal occupants of his literary Valhalla, and William Faulkner the god of his particular idolatry. At that time, my knowledge of American literature was confined to Emerson, Poe, Walt Whitman, and Harriet Beecher Stowe. Of the moderns, I knew nothing, and if, years later, I got round to reading Faulkner and certain of his contemporaries, this was to some extent due to my discussions with Arunjave Rask at Kar in the winter of 1955-56. Not that our discussions at his flat and in taxis and Irani tea shops on our occasional joint forays into town were by any means restricted to literature. They ranged over a variety of topics, from politics to sex, from Buddhism to the Japanese film. We also talked about ourselves. At least Rask talked about himself. As I already knew, his mother tongue was Punjabi and his preferred literary medium, Urdu, in which he had written poetry. Rask was not his surname, i.e. caste name, but his poetic nom de plume, and as such rightly to be enclosed within single inverted commas. What I did not know was that he had not been born in India. He had been born and brought up in Burma, in Rangoon, at the time of the Japanese invasion, when he was still in his teens. He and his family had fled as refugees to India, making the last part of their journey on foot through the jungles of Burma and Assam. In this connection, he had a curious story to tell. Like the tale told me by Visuddhisara, it was one to which only the pen of a Lafcadio Hearn, in this case the Hearn of the late Japanese ghost stories, or perhaps in a different style, the pen of a Somerset Maugham, could have done justice. A year or so before the invasion, he had consulted an astrologer about his future. Not that he had much faith in astrology then, he explained, but most Hindus believed in it, even English-educated ones. And being on the threshold of manhood and uncertain which direction in life to take, his real ambition was to be a poet. He thought he may as well find out what the stars had to say on the subject, if indeed they had or could have anything to say on it. To his surprise, the astrologer, after making his calculations, professed himself extremely puzzled. He could tell his client what he saw, he declared, but not its meaning. What he saw was a broad track through dense jungle. On either side of the track, for its entire length, human skeletons were lying. And along this track, between the skeletons, his teenage client was walking, tired and hungry, with the sun blazing overhead, and the vultures circling. A year or so later, the prediction, for such it turned out to have been, was strangely and tragically fulfilled. With what remained of his family, Rask told me, a more sombre expression than usual clouding his pleasant, irregularly shaped countenance, he had found himself in just such a jungle as the astrologer had described, stumbling along just such a track, fleeing as fast as his failing strength permitted from the advancing Japanese troops. He must have passed thousands of skeletons, their bones picked clean by vultures, the remains of those Indian and European refugees, indistinguishable now in death, who had fallen exhausted by the wayside and perished before they could reach safety. As a result of this experience, he said in conclusion, he had developed a certain amount of faith in astrology. At least he no longer dismissed it out of hand. There were good astrologers in Bombay, one of whom came to the flat every month and gave him the benefit of his, or the stars, advice and guidance. That this was the case I already knew, having seen a thin, elderly Brahmin arriving one morning and being shown into the bedroom, where he remained closeted with Rask for an hour, for what, the latter afterwards told me, was a professional consultation. What I did not know was that before I left Bombay, I would be having, in connection with that same elderly Brahmin, a curious story of my own to tell. As a Buddhist, I had no faith in astrology, in the sense that I did not believe that the relative positions of the stars and planets determined events on Earth, including events in individual lives. Had not the Buddha, as Bodhisattva in the Jataka book, scornfully demanded in words my rationalist friend Anandji was fond of quoting, "Kim Karasanti Taraka," what can the stars do? Yet the resemblance between Rask's experience as he journeyed on foot through the jungles of Burma and Assam and what the Rangoon astrologer had predicted was too close to be explicable in terms of pure coincidence. A clue was perhaps to be found in the fact that the astrologer had, as it appeared, spoken of seeing the track through the jungle, the human skeletons, and his client walking between them. Perhaps it was a case not of his having predicted Rask's future in accordance with calculations made on the basis of a reading of the stars, but rather of his having seen that future clairvoyantly by means of a precognitive faculty that had been brought into play as a result of the intense concentration the making of those calculations required. Be that as it may, one story about the occult led to another, as usually happened when that fascinating subject was broached, And I think it was on this occasion that I told Rush about my own precognitive experiences as a teenager, when I saw what was going to happen to me, though not what was going to happen to others, half an hour or so beforehand, as well as about my seeing Buddharachita clairvoyantly one night when he was several hundred miles away. I did not, however, tell him about a strange experience that had befallen me much more recently under his own hospitable roof and in the very room in which we were sitting. I did not tell him about it, partly because it was not occult in the sense that clairvoyance and precognition were occult, being an experience of an entirely different order, and partly because I had no words with which to describe it. It was an experience of presence, with a capital P, or perhaps I should say of a presence. Though what was present was definitely not a thing but a person, not that presence and person were really distinguishable. Equally, the presentness was not that of any particular person. Moreover, the presence was spatially located. It occupied a certain corner of the room, the one nearest the door, which, as I sat cross-legged on the sofa writing, was to my left. Objectively speaking, it was a strange experience, but though I recognised it intellectually as being strange, I never felt it to be so. There was nothing spooky about the presence, and when it was there in its usual corner, not that it has any dimensions, I felt quite comfortable with it and at home. It always appeared, not that I ever actually saw anything, when I was alone, perhaps when I'd been alone for some time and while I was writing. By now, the end of the survey was in sight, and I was working on the penultimate and anti-penultimate sections of the last chapter, which dealt, respectively, with the thought of enlightenment and the 10 perfections. As this whole chapter, and these two sections in particular, were devoted to the Bodhisattva ideal, the, quote, perfectly ripened fruit of the whole vast tree of Buddhism, unquote, as I then believed it to be, I could not forbear wondering later on if there had been a connection between my strange experience and the lofty ideal about which I was writing. Might not the presence have been that of a bodhisattva, or even of the Buddha? But this was only speculation after the event. What I experienced at the time was presence, or a presence, not any particular person, good or bad, human or divine. Just personal-impersonal presence. The presence appeared when I was alone, or rather, did not appear when I was not alone. But I was not often alone, especially after Rashk, his outside business apparently concluded, started bethinking himself of the unfinished script of Ajanta and of the work we were supposed to be doing on it together. The time I was least alone, both before and after our getting down to serious work on the long-neglected script, was the evening, this being the time, usually when Rashk's friends called on him, and when we, though more rarely, went to see them. His friends were all men, at least I remember no women, though he appeared to be acquainted with some of the wives. And most of them belonged to, or were connected with, the film industry, whether as producers, directors, actors, scriptwriters, musicians or artists. The friend of whom we saw most, and whom I got to know best, was tall, portly Jai Raj, a South Indian in his early or middle 40s, who, Rashk told me, had played the hero in more than 30 Tamil mythological films. What was of greater interest to me, he also happened to be a nephew, by marriage, I think, of Sarojini Naidu, the Nightingale of India, on whose poetry, shortly after my arrival in India, I had written an article. Like other members of Rashk's circle, he had a genuine interest in religion and philosophy, as his library attested, and we had more than one discussion on these subjects. Producers accepted. Most of those who worked in the film industry were, I found, much less interested in their actual jobs than they were in doing other things. Rashk himself, I remembered, had told me on my early visit to Bombay that he wrote film scripts only because he could not afford to write poetry. Similarly, Akshrikar, who was Raj Kapoor's art director and designer of the Mahabodhi Journal's new cover, would rather have been painting pictures. And Abbas, a more successful scriptwriter than Rushdie, would have preferred to be adding another popular novel to his oeuvre. Besides the people I met of an evening, there were those I saw in the course of my forays into town, both with and without Rushdie. As my work on the survey drew to a close, I must have finished it early in the new year, these forays became not only more frequent, but longer and more of the nature of excursions. On four or five of these I gave lectures, and on one of them presided over the World Religions Day meeting, organised by the Baha'i community. This last-named event, which went off even better than the organisers had dared to hope, was attended by representatives of an astonishing variety of religions, sects and cults. Bombay was not just a cosmopolitan city, not just a whole world in itself. It was a world within which there was a multitude of sub-worlds, religious, cultural, linguistic and so on, most of which overlapped only to a limited extent. During the months of December and January, I became acquainted, or better acquainted, with at least three of these subworlds. One cultural, if the film industry subworld could indeed be so categorised, one religious and one socio-religious, as well as with the three outstanding personalities by which they were severally dominated. As there was no overlap between the three subworlds, and as in each of them I appeared in a different capacity and functioned in a different manner, though still as a Buddhist monk. During this period I was leading, in a sense, three different lives, or past lives, and expending my energies in three different directions. Often all three lives, or past lives, were lived on different days of the same week, or even at different hours of the same day, so that, in the interests of consecutive narration, each life is best dealt with separately from the other two. As Ruskin observes in Praeterea, his autobiography, quote, "Whether in the biography of a nation or of a single person, it is alike impossible to trace it steadily through successive years. Some forces are failing, while others strengthen, and most act irregularly, or else at uncorresponding periods of renewed enthusiasm after intervals of lassitude. For all clearness of exposition, it is necessary to follow first one, then another, without confusing notices of what is happening in other directions." End of quote. What is true of successive years may be equally true, sometimes, of the days and weeks of two successive months, even if, in their case, it might be a question not so much of forces failing and strengthening, as of different forces being deployed at different times, according to circumstances. The part I played within each of my Bombay subworlds was to a great extent determined, at least initially, by my relationship with its leading personality. In the film industry, certainly in the important part of it that was RK Films, the leading personality was Raj Kapoor. On my 1952 visit to the city, when he had shared with me his ideas for a film with a Buddhist theme to be called Ajanta, we must have met a dozen or more times. Miss Nargis, his principal leading lady, was usually by his side. This time we met only twice or thrice, and he was alone, in the sense that Nargis was not there. As before, we met at the cottage, Raj Kapoor's private quarters at RK Studios, Chembur. At our first meeting, after I'd gone onto the set and seen some shooting, discussion naturally soon turned to Ajanta. Though we discussed it at some length, indeed until quite late into the night, I formed the impression that his mind was really on other things. This impression was not unconnected with the fact that in the course of the evening he had brought out from an inner drawer, with the air of a card player revealing a winning hand, a sheaf of black and white photographs of his latest discovery, an attractive Anglo-Indian girl whom he had met quite by accident in Delhi. She had the makings of a fine actress. he assured me, his eyes gleaming, and he had promised her a leading role in one of his films. On our way back to Carr, Rashk enlightened me as to the background of the story. Relations between Raj Kapoor and Nargis were strained, and he was looking for a new principal leading lady. Whether she was to be given the leading female role in Ajanta, he did not know. Personally, he did not think Nargis could be so easily replaced. But with or without Nargis, Raj Kapoor would, he was confident, make the film. Achrakar had already designed costumes for it, and created in his room at RK Studios a plaster and clay model of the main set. Rashk was also confident that the film would be a financial success and that Raj Kapoor would be happy to give me, out of the proceeds, the 20,000 rupees that would be required for the monastery I wanted to build in Kalimpong. Perhaps I would call the monastery the Ajanta Vihara. The next time Raj Kapoor and I met at the cottage, he was in a very different mood, in fact, in a very different mental state altogether. Nor was he alone. Not that it was Nargis who was with him. On this occasion, he had for companion the bottle of Black Label, on which it was his habit, apparently, to rely for moral support at times of crisis, or when he was feeling particularly sorry for himself. The plain truth was that he was drunk, though not so drunk that we were not able to have a long, if rather inconsequential, discussion, which he insisted on tape recording for the benefit of posterity. The discussion was punctuated by maudlin outbursts in which he lamented the loss of his discovery and upbraided her for her treachery, deceitfulness, and ingratitude. She had ruined his life, he declared to heart-rending sobs. She had destroyed him. Once again it was Rashk who enlightened me as to the background of the story. The Anglo-Indian girl had come to Bombay. RK Studios had flown her there. Her screen tests had proved highly satisfactory, and Raj Kapoor had become more convinced of her talent and more infatuated with her every day. But last week there had come a message. Would he meet her in town at a certain fashionable restaurant? On entering the place, he found, to his astonishment, that his discovery was not alone. She was with a good-looking young man. He was still more astonished when she introduced the young man as her fiancé. They were going to be married quite soon, she said. But what about your film career? A shocked Raj Kapoor had demanded, clutching at a straw. Oh, my fiancé is a multimillionaire, she replied. He's ready to make as many films for me as I want. The leading personality in the Society of Servants of God was Dr. Dinsa Mehta. This was the same mysterious Dr. Mehta whom the short, middle-aged woman who had claimed my exclusive attention after the second Arya Sangha lecture had been so anxious I should meet. True to her word, she had come to the Ananda Vihara a few days later and taken me to her Marine Drive flat for tea. There I learnt that Dinu Dubash, as she was called, was a Parsi by birth, but a Buddhist at heart, that she was a Montessori teacher, having trained with Madame Montessori herself in Italy in the 30s, that she was an insomniac, that the rest of the flat was occupied by her Montessori school, and that she wanted to give 1,000 rupees for the Buddha Jayanti. In between, she scolded the cook, gave me, or tried to give me, a sumptuous tea, showed me her Buddhist books, many of them heavily underlined, as well as her watercolour paintings, among which there was a series of striking portraits of the blue-eyed, golden-haired figure who had appeared to her in meditation, and whom she believed to be the Buddha Maitreya. I also learned that Dr. Mehta was by profession a naturopath, in fact a well-known one, that my hostess had once been a patient of his, and that he had founded the Society of Servants of God 3 years earlier. Originally, it had been called the Society of Servants, Miss Dubash confided, not without a smile of good-natured amusement. But people thought it was a domestic servants agency, and kept telephoning about cooks and bearers, and Dr. Mehta had been forced to change it. She herself was not a member of the society, at least not a member of the inner circle, nor did she believe in all its teachings, or accept everything Dr. Mehta said, even though it was supposed to come from God. But she liked the society's emphasis on meditation, and for that reason, sometimes attended its meetings. Despite her excitedness and volubility, her skittishness even, Dino Dubash was, I could see, an essentially serious-minded person with a genuine devotion to the spiritual life. She was like a little babbling brook, whose excess of foam, as it skips and dances down from the hills, conceals the depth and translucency of its water. I was therefore all the more disposed to treat seriously her reiterated wish that I should meet Dr. Mehta and see what I thought of the Society of Servants of God, without allowing myself to be inhibited by the fact that its members were dedicated to the service of a being in whose existence good Buddhists did not believe. As it happened, I had already been approached by a stout, shifty-eyed young representative of the society and invited to address the servants of God on, quote, love and devotion in Buddhism. And one morning, 3 weeks after taking tea with Dinu Dubash, accordingly found myself being escorted by the same shifty-eyed young man from car to the flat on Malabar Hill that was the society's headquarters. The flat was located on the ground floor of Mayfair, a block of luxury apartments not far from the Hanging Gardens. From the gloomy hallway there was a dark, narrow passage between what seemed to be wooden cubicles, and at the end of this passage, a sunny room, furnished, Indian style, with white-covered mattresses and bolsters. Opposite the door, his back against the far wall, sat a grizzled-haired, grossly corpulent figure in close-fitting muslin tunic and white cotton jodhpurs. On the floor beside him rested a telephone set, while in front of him a portable electric fan, swivelling energetically from side to side, sent a swathe of cold air in his direction. He welcomed me cordially, if with a certain solemnity, a smile of satisfaction on his grey, flabby features, after which the two of us got down to a serious discussion, mainly about meditation, that lasted for the remainder of the morning and well into the afternoon. Several members of the society were present, as was Miss Dubash, but apart from the last named, whose tongue could not be easily restrained, they were content to lean back against their bolsters and listen. After lunch, eaten from thalis in the same room, and solemnly blessed before being served, Dr. Mehta, for indeed it was he, read to me from what he called the scripts. The scripts, I gathered, were the written records of the guidance he had received over the last few years, when in a state of deep meditation. They were of various lengths, though none of them comprised more than a couple of thousand words. Some were in verse, some in prose. The verse scripts, which were the shortest, reminded me, in their general tone and tenor, of the earlier shorter surahs of the Quran. But long or short, in verse or in prose, and regardless of their actual subject matter, whether hortatory or consolatory, practical or deeply metaphysical, all the scripts from which Dr. Mehta read that afternoon were couched in the first person singular. Who, then, was the speaker? According to the society, and indeed the scripts themselves, it was none other than God. It was God who, through the servant of servants, Dr. Mehta, directed the affairs of the society and the lives of its members. The scripts were thus a species of divine revelation, similar in content, if not in form, to the revelations vouchsafed by the prophets and founders of religions in the past, from Zoroaster to Muhammad. That the members of the society, at least the members of what Dinu Dubash had called the inner circle, believed its affairs, as well as their own lives, to be personally guided by the Almighty, meant that their involvement with it had a special significance for them. It also meant that the involvement had a certain depth of seriousness. Something of that seriousness was apparent in the faces of the 30 or more people who, later on in the afternoon, squeezed into the room to hear me speak on love and devotion in Buddhism. I was glad to have the opportunity of speaking on this subject. Indeed, it may have been of my own selection. Even in a city like Bombay, supposedly the cultural as well as the commercial capital of India, the few who knew anything at all about Buddhism usually thought of it as a sturdy rationalism or sterile agnosticism, in which there was no place for devotion. And I wanted to disabuse the servants of God, at least, of any such idea, and in this way remove whatever prejudice they might have had against Buddhism. Love was of three kinds, depending on whether it was directed towards a person or an object superior, equal, or inferior to ourselves. The first kind of love was called Shraddha, the second Maitri, the third Karuna. And on each in turn I spoke at some length, giving examples from the Pali scriptures and explaining how it was to be developed. In Buddhism, the principal object of Shraddha, or devotion, was the Buddha, the enlightened human teacher, the embodiment of reality, just as in the theistic religions it was the creator. I also emphasised that Shraddha was to be balanced by prajna, or wisdom. Even though the predominantly emotional factors of bliss, joy and equanimity played an important part in spiritual life right up to the attainment of nirvana. Nirvana itself was both absolute wisdom and infinite compassion. Since the Buddha had no superior and no equal, in relation to ordinary humanity, it was compassion that was the most prominent aspect of enlightenment. Compassion was characteristic of Buddhism, perhaps its most important teaching. It was because of the compassion he felt that the Buddha spent his life showing the path to others. His actions had all been the spontaneous overflow of his love for sentient beings. My talk was well received and followed by a discussion initiated by Dr. Mehta on meditation as a source of nutrition. This enabled me to describe the four kinds of nutriment recognized in Buddhism, as well as to relate how the Buddha, in the course of his early struggles for enlightenment, had refused to allow the devas to provide him with celestial nourishment. These particulars Dr. Mehta seemed to find especially interesting. The servant of servants indeed had followed my talk with close attention, and a week or two later, when I attended a lecture on the economic structure of Islam, it was in Urdu, which I could not follow very well, he asked me to give another talk and engaged me in further discussion about meditation. This second talk, which I gave a few days later, was on the Buddha and the spiritual life in Buddhism. I spoke for nearly 2 hours, and whether on account of the concentrated meditative atmosphere of the meeting, or because I was upheld by the sustaining power of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, I gave what I afterwards thought was one of the best talks I'd ever given, and probably the profoundest. At any rate, the audience was sufficiently impressed, and it was evident that some of its members, at least, were beginning to realise that there was more to Buddhism than they had imagined. In the weeks that followed, I paid several more visits to Mayfair, and had further discussions with Dr. Mehta about meditation, as well as about Buddhism. He also read to me from the scripts, of which there were about 2,000. At least this was the figure given by the youngest woman in a white sari who appeared to be Dr. Mehta's chief disciple, and who, I subsequently learned, ran the quality control business that was the society's principal source of income. Sundri Vaswani, as her name was, also told me that a large proportion of the scripts had been received in the first year or so of the Society's existence, when Dr. Mehta had sat for guidance several times a day. Nowadays he sat for guidance only occasionally, she said a little regretfully, I thought. Nonetheless, before leaving Bombay, perhaps I would have an opportunity of being present when he sat and seeing him receive guidance in meditation. It so happened that I did have an opportunity. There was no meeting at Mayfair that evening, and only the members of the inner circle were present in the room. Besides Dr. Mehta himself, this consisted of Sundri Vaswani and her brother Hira, the shifty-eyed young man. Durgardus Birla, a minor member of the famous business family, and his bespectacled wife, and Father Mascarenhas, an elderly, disaffected Goanese Catholic priest, who was fond of denouncing, at least within the walls of Mayfair, the iniquities of what he called the Roman racket. Proceedings began with a kind of group meditation. Dr. Metta then went into what appeared to be a trance state, turning up his eyes until only the whites were visible. After a while he closed them. His right hand was seized with a violent trembling, and snatching up a pen, he began scribbling furiously on the top sheet of the stack of paper that had been kept in readiness before him. I was sitting beside him on the same mattress, and observed that his eyes remained closed during the whole time he was writing, and that he could not see what he was doing. Sheet after sheet he covered, sundry snatching away each one as it was finished, and making sure the sheet underneath was so positioned that his pen did not run off the paper. When seven or eight sheets had been covered, he suddenly stopped, and his head slumped forward onto his chest. God had again spoken and given his guidance. Another script had come into existence. When the light was switched on, I saw that the servant of servants' face was greyer than ever, and that he was bathed in perspiration. The socio-religious subworld of the Scheduled Castes Federation was much bigger than the religious subworld of the Society of Servants of God. I had met Dr. B. R. Ambedkar, the leading personality of the Federation, in 1952, after having been in correspondence with him 2 years earlier. On that occasion we had met at Rajgir, his residence in Dadar, in the heart of industrial Bombay, and I had asked him, probably with his recent article, The Buddha and the Future of His Religion, in mind, whether he thought Buddhism had a future in India. His reply was an indirect one. He had no future in India, he declared bitterly. He was at that time in the political wilderness. As if his own future in India and that of Buddhism were inextricably interconnected. But his attitude, or at least his mood, had since changed. Having realised, after a lifetime of unsuccessful campaigning, that the caste Hindus were not going to give up their traditional inhuman treatment of the untouchables, as the scheduled castes and depressed class people were popularly known, he had come to the conclusion that he and his followers would have to change their religion. They would have to become Buddhists, Buddhism being a religion that was of Indian origin, that was rational, and that treated men and women according to their worth, not their birth, that is, not according to their hereditary caste. Within the last few months he had twice visited Buddhist Burma, and only days before our second meeting, which took place on the 25th of December, he had installed an image of the Buddha in a temple that had been built by members of the Scheduled Castes community at Deu Road near Pune. We met not in Dadar, but in the fort area of Bombay, in Dr. Ambedkar's office, on the top floor of Buddha Bhavan, one of the buildings of the Siddharth College of Arts and Science. In appearance, he was greatly altered. At the time of our first meeting, his demeanour had been belligerent, and his expression grim and lowering, and though inclining to corpulence, he had seemed in good health. Now, 3 years later, he was quieter and more subdued, and so crippled by arthritis that, as he explained when apologising for receiving me sitting down, he could stand only with difficulty. But though quieter and more subdued, he had, as it seemed, made up his mind that he and his followers should become Buddhists, and was even now drawing up plans for the revival of Buddhism in India. These plans he explained to me at some length, adding, with evident emotion, that he intended to devote the rest of his life to Buddhism. Mrs. Ambedkar, who stood beside him as he sat behind his desk, appeared to support his plans, and from time to time intervened to reinforce a point he had made, especially when his energy flagged. For my part, I explained, in response to Dr. Ambedkar's inquiries, that formal conversion to Buddhism consisted in going for refuge to the three jewels, that is, the Buddha, the Dharma and the Sangha, and in undertaking to observe the five basic principles of ethical behaviour. One could take the refuges and precepts from any monk or other senior Buddhist. All the same, he and his followers would be well advised to take them from someone like Yu Chandramani of Kusinara, probably the senior-most monk in India, rather than from a junior monk like myself. Dr. Ambedkar had asked me if I would be willing to perform the conversion ceremony for them, as the Buddhist world would probably then take their conversion to Buddhism more seriously. Before we parted, the scheduled caste's leader asked me to write to him, recapitulating what I had said about conversion. He also asked me to explain to his followers what conversion to Buddhism really meant. On my acceding to both these requests, he promised to see that a talk was organised for me by his lieutenants in the city. Dr. Ambedkar was as good as his word, with the result that on New Year's Day, I addressed a meeting of some 3,000 people on what it means to become a Buddhist. It was not the first time I had spoken to members of the scheduled caste community on this burning topic, as it was fast becoming for all of them. Only days before my meeting with Dr. Ambedkar, I had addressed the residents of the so-called Harijan colony at Kar, and had afterwards explained to its elders the implications of conversion to Buddhism. Compared to the meeting now organised for me by Dr. Ambedkar's local henchmen, this had been a very small affair, and it was clear that there would be no conversion to Buddhism, at least not on a mass scale, unless the scheduled caste's leader himself took the first step. The meeting took place at Worli, on a piece of waste ground overlooked by a row of chawls or tenement blocks. And since many of Ambedkar's followers were factory workers who did not get home much before 8 o'clock, it did not begin until quite late. By that time there was a cold wind blowing, so that when I at last rose to speak, I was shivering in my thin cotton robes. With the president of the Bombay branch of the Scheduled Castes Federation of Bombay giving a running translation into Marathi, I addressed the gathering for more than an hour, speaking as simply as I could, and confining myself to fundamentals. Becoming a Buddhist meant going for refuge to the Buddha, the Dharma and the Sangha, I explained, just as I had to Dr. Ambedkar, as well as undertaking to observe the five precepts. But one could not truly go for refuge unless one understood what it was to which one went for refuge. The greater part of my talk was therefore devoted to explaining that the Buddha was a human being who had gained enlightenment by his personal efforts, not an avatar of the god Vishnu. That the Dharma, or teaching of the Buddha, was the principal way to enlightenment, especially as represented by the three trainings of morality, meditation and wisdom, and by the Noble Eightfold Path. And that the Sangha was the spiritual community of the Buddha's disciples, past and present, monk and lay. In speaking about the Dharma refuge, I was at pains to emphasise that in Buddhism the word Dharma possessed a meaning quite different from that which it bore in Hinduism. In the latter, it meant one's duty as determined by the hereditary caste to which one belonged. If one had been born as a Brahmin, one's duty was to study the Vedas and receive offerings. If as a Shudra, to serve the members of the three higher castes. If one had been born as an untouchable, then of course one's duty was to remove night soil and animal carcasses, and to avoid polluting caste Hindus by coming into contact with them. According to Hinduism, one could no more change one's dharma than one could change one's caste. It would be a sin even to try to change it. In Buddhism, however, the Dharma, capital D, in the sense of the way to enlightenment, was the same for all human beings, regardless of caste, which in any case was not recognised by Buddhism. Becoming a Buddhist and practising the Dharma meant, among other things, breaking free from the caste system and from untouchability, and following a path of ethical and spiritual development that was for the benefit of oneself and others. Sitting there on the bare ground, my poorly clad and mostly illiterate audience followed my talk with the closest attention, and in a silence that was broken only by the applause that greeted any remark of which they particularly approved. Not surprisingly, the greatest applause was reserved for my comments on caste and untouchability. From the warmth with which the organisers congratulated me on my talk after the meeting, I left Worley that night with the impression that, provided Dr. Ambedkar lived long enough, Buddhism did have a future in India. The end of chapter 19.